Stream. Group Stream is going to launch in the United States first.
The idea started when we noticed that during the Egyptian Revolution, Egyptians were documenting a country's history in real time on social media and Facebook and Twitter and photos and videos on cell phones and cameras.
The technology isn't just for those documenting a revolution or other news events. Elayat shows me the group stream of two of her friends. They recently threw a housewarming party in San Francisco.
The way you jump in a stream is just you click the jump in stream button and it jumps into this visual revisualization of all their media fragments. So it'll be a combination of photos off of Facebook and Flickr, and tweets and Facebook posts.
We have a picture of the San Francisco skyline, and then we have a couple of frittatas that they have posted pictures of. So this is what their housewarming party looked like.
So the idea is the next step is they could invite now the people. There are people who are at their party, and the people who are at their party can now also add their perspective of this housewarming party of, you know, almost like if you're sitting around a dinner table and having a conversation about what this was like.
Google will crown the winning business in May of this year. In the meantime, many of the entrepreneurs say, win or lose, they believe their businesses have the potential to be the next big thing in post-revolutionary Egypt. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
Today marks the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. King was shot on a hotel balcony in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was supporting striking sanitation workers and planning an upcoming campaign in Washington to advocate for the rights of poor people. 1 month earlier, Dr. King spoke in Los Angeles about the push for economic justice.
And developing a movement that is dramatic and attention-getting so that for at least 60 days, nobody in this country can overlook the fact that there are poor people around. And we solicit your support as we go to Washington, not to beg, but to demand jobs or income now.
Today, civil rights groups are launching an initiative to reduce youth violence through a public health initiative. Robert Adams is the chief operating officer of the Martin Luther King Institute for Social Justice and Human Rights. He spoke to reporters today on a teleconference town hall about the importance of focusing on stopping youth violence.
We're trying to use this day not just to celebrate a life well lived and committed to social justice, but to imagine how we can become active participants in realizing Dr. King's dream. And part of one of the big challenges of our times is preventing and solving youth violence in urban and rural communities across this country.
Health workers at the town hall described youth violence as an epidemic. The initiative is in partnership with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and will include public education and mental health services. Homicide is the leading cause of death for African Americans between the ages of 10 and 24, and the second leading cause of death for Asians, American Indians, and Latinos of that age, according to the CDC. As people across the country reflect on the legacy of Dr. King, many are also paying tribute to another civil rights icon, Elizabeth Catlett, renowned sculptor and printmaker whose combination of art and social justice made her one of the most notable African-American artists of the 20th century, died Monday in her home in Cuernavaca, Mexico. For more on Catlett's life and work, we speak with Melanie Herzog, professor of art history at Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin. She's also the author of Elizabeth Catlett, an American artist in Mexico. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Catlett's lifetime spanned 9 decades. Talk about her work and the conditions she lived through as a young woman.
It's rather amazing to think about all of what Elizabeth Catlett experienced in her life. She was born in 1915, grew up in Washington, D.C., when that was a very segregated city. When she went to college, she had intended to go to Carnegie Technical Institute, which is now Carnegie Mellon, and was denied entrance because they discovered that she was black after they had admired her work. And so she went to school at Howard University, where she was really at the center of a number of conversations about what modern African-American art should be. And so she kind of came of age thinking about what it meant to be a black artist, what her responsibilities were as a black artist.
Well, and as you describe, these experiences would shape her work. She often drew on real-world events, looking at issues of race, ethnicity, gender, class struggles. Describe a couple of her most well-known pieces.
Well, there are quite a few important works. One of her important prints is a print that's now known as Sharecropper. It's this very powerful, dignified image of an older woman who is presumably somebody who makes her living working in the fields. And it's this dignified image. It speaks to the resistance of working people, the survival of working people, despite the multiple oppressions that they face. And this image was initially published in Mexico. It won a prize in one of the Atlanta University annual art competitions. And then in the 1960s, she reworked the image, added color, and it became a very, very powerful assertion of black women's presence in this country. So it's interesting that perhaps one of her most famous prints is one that speaks across cultural borders. It speaks to her audience in Mexico, speaks to her audience here in the United States, and really has resonated around the world as a very powerful print. She also made a number of prints about Harriet Tubman, who was a heroic figure for her and somebody who she represented for many years.
Well, Catlett spent much of her life in Mexico, as you describe. Some of these pieces were received in Mexico, and she had that audience perhaps in mind when she was working on them. How did the people and the place there influence her work?
I think the biggest influence on her work in Mexico was the Taller de Gráfica Popular, which was really her primary community of artists, certainly in the late 40s and the early 1950s, because here she learned that rather than art being an individual enterprise that's about individual expression, that art can be something that speaks for a movement, that speaks on behalf of a collectivity of people, and that art doesn't have to be about what you want to say yourself, but can be about speaking as clearly and strongly as possible about the aims of whatever struggle it is that you're working for. So that had a huge impact on her work, and it really made her understand that art has to speak clearly. If art is being made in the service of social change, that it has to be able to raise consciousness of injustice and illuminate possibilities for social transformation.
Because of her politics, she was the subject of U.S. government monitoring and had trouble securing visas to re-enter the U.S., is that right?
She was not able to re-enter the United States during the years when she was considered an undesirable alien, which was 1962 to 1971. She was barred from entry to this country. And then after that, she was able to get visas to come to the United States for her exhibitions, and she started to have many more of those after 1971. Ultimately, in 2002, I believe it was, the United States government told her that somehow her U.S. citizenship had never actually been, that she had not given up her U.S. citizenship when she became a Mexican citizen, and so now she had, so she was then granted dual citizenship and was allowed to travel more freely to the United States. I think she became so well known in this country that they realized that they had made a terrible mistake.
Melanie Herzog is professor of art history at Edgewood College. She's also the author of Elizabeth Catlett, an American artist in Mexico. She joined us from Madison, Wisconsin, to discuss the life and work of Elizabeth Catlett, who died this week at the age of 96. Melanie Herzog, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's really an honor to speak with you and your audience.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kampf. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
session, it's a session. One more lesson coming out the mouth. I got no doubt that I'm gonna be on the path. How we gonna do it? I don't know, I got no answers. Just a lot of fucking people. Yo, my spine is cancer. I got a lot of heart, I got a lot of soul. And if we step outside, I might even have to go smoke a whoa. I'm not gonna talk about that, cause like a fucking hot hat, my top hat got snatched by the Mad Hatter. And then we're gonna go fucking chit chatter. And all my folks get up and fucking put your rice on a platter and be proud as you eat your tamales. Don't forget about the frijoles and don't forget about the tortillas. Yo, my fucking Pancho Villas, where you at? My zapatos, por favor, take off your hat. Do whatever the hell you need to. Fucking step up, yo. Fighting oppression's been going on for 513 years, yo. Thank you. Yeah, I got a show every Monday night, 101.1. Yeah, check it out. Augusto Cesar Sandino Segundo, Paz.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
Denuncias de brutalidad policial contra estudiantes de un colegio público en California.
They were buoyed by, I think, the just the sheer courage of the family that endured these crimes.
Condenan a sentencias de hasta 65 años de prisión a policías que dispararon a civiles afectados por el huracán Katrina en Nueva Orleans hace 6 años. Un nuevo suicidio en Grecia por la difícil situación económica, empeorada por las medidas de austeridad del gobierno.
Inmediatamente después del desalojo violento por la policía y el ejército, el presidente decretó la extinción de nuestra fuente de trabajo Luz y Fuerza del Centro.
La planta ya volvió a abrir porque el gobierno federal se ha dado a la tarea de apapachar al Grupo México, ya que el Grupo México de Germán Larrea Mota Velasco pues fue un patrocinador de la campaña de Felipe Calderón.
Y revisaremos el legado de la administración de Felipe Calderón en el sector laboral, en particular la situación de los mineros y los trabajadores del Sindicato Mexicano de Electricistas. A continuación, detalles de estas y otras noticias en la edición de hoy del Informativo Pacífica. Les saluda Norma Martínez. Acompáñenos.
Iniciamos con algunas noticias destacadas en las últimas horas.
5 expolicías de Nueva Orleans fueron condenados a penas de entre 6 y 65 años de prisión por matar a 2 hombres desarmados y herir a otros 4 miembros de una familia días después del paso del destructivo huracán Katrina en Luisiana. Las víctimas mortales fueron James Brissett, de 17 años de edad, y Ronald Madison, un discapacitado mental de 40 años. Los exoficiales estadounidenses conspiraron para plantar un arma a las víctimas, fabricaron testigos y falsificaron reportes para justificar la balacera contra 6 civiles el 4 de septiembre del 2005. En agosto del 2011, los expolicías Kenneth Bowen, Robert Falcón, Robert Gisebius y Anthony Villavaso fueron encontrados culpables de 25 violaciones a los derechos civiles. El miércoles, el juez Kurt Engelhardt sentenció a Bowen y Gisebius a 40 años de cárcel y a Villavaso a 38. Falcón recibió 65 años de condena. Por su parte, el exdetective Arthur Kaufman, quien no participó en el tiroteo, fue condenado a 6 años de prisión por encubrir el crimen, falsificando reportes y diciendo mentiras. Según testigos, el 4 de septiembre del 2005...
Ahora, en inglés, coming up next, Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Stay tuned. It's April 5th, 2012.
Oriental de Luisiana, Jim Leffen, dijo que el caso fue reconstruido de las cenizas de un...
and they seem to criminalize when the only crime we're guilty of is our hope for a better life. They may have the tanks and their bombs and their guns and their money and their lies, but we know we're right. Feel the weight on your shoulders. Is it only me or think that might
Yeah, that was a little more of Sarah Marlowe from her album Times Like These. Name of the cut was, I don't know if we call it a cut on a CD, but it's Not As They Seem. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, and also a stream if you can find it. I'm Robert Norris. This is the Bathrop's Pier's Broadside Show, and I'm, of course, Bathrop's Pier himself, in case you want to meet me, just call up 427-3772, and I will introduce myself again in case you missed me the first time. You can also try 469-3119. Again, the two numbers, both in area code 831, are 427-3772 and 469-3119. I'm going to begin the show with a little bit from an interview with Daniel Ellsberg, a guy called Scott Horton, who does regular work for antiwar.org, a libertarian website, which I sometimes agree with, and frequently, actually, on issues of war and peace, and sometimes don't, on economic issues, has a much longer interview. I'm going to give you a little tease by playing the beginning of it, and then we'll turn to more regular programming in the show, which is usually I do a lot of interviewing. Sometimes I've got a guest or two wandering around the studio. Not tonight, I don't think, although it's possible that steadfast Steve Plaich may be wandering in to talk about his machinations with the local American Civil Liberties Union or other attempts to end the machinations of the ACLU and get it moving in an actually civil libertarian direction that really addresses local civil liberties issues. But that's sometimes hard to do, hard to corral that guy. He's walking everywhere. There's also a General Assembly happening, for those of you who are interested. I understand last night there was a showing of the film V is for Vendetta, which is a great movie. I enjoyed it a lot when I saw it, 5-6 years ago, whenever it first came out. It was shown on the steps of the courthouse facing Water Street, and that was started, I think, at 8 o'clock at night, and that was, my goodness, an hour into the dreaded curfew declared by Chief Administrative Officer Susan Mariello of the county overlords. And apparently, I heard there was no attempts to arrest the felonious movie-watching audience. So that's good news. Maybe there'll be no attempts to harass the General Assembly, which begins at began 10 minutes ago, begins at 6 every Tuesday and Thursday on those steps. And though it's diminished in numbers, there are people who are continuing to be active, far more so, I might say, than a year ago, which I think, it's not as much, certainly as much as it was 6 months ago, but I'd like to think I'm thankful for small favors. We'll see. In the meantime, if you're not wandering over to the General Assembly, then listen to a little of this interview of the aging Daniel Ellsberg. He's the author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and has recently, according to this, written an article for Nuclear Security Beyond Seoul, Eradicate Land-Based Doomsday Missiles. Seoul, of course, is the capital of South Korea. I don't know if I say, I don't really recognize recognize the way it's spelled, but if somebody said Seoul, I might not pick up on it. S-E-O-U-L, that's the capital of South Korea. Ellsberg talks about the slow pace of nuclear weapons reductions, despite much lip service from every U.S. president since Carter, the surprising low number of hydrogen bombs required to cause nuclear winter and effectively end life on Earth. redefining nuclear deterrence in terms of dozens of missiles instead of thousands, why everyone loses in nuclear war, even the nation to get a first strike, and the complete list of references for the scientific studies, data, and historical incidents. The historical incidences mentioned in the article. And he has a forthcoming book, does Daniel Ellsberg, The American Doomsday Machine. In 1959, Ellsberg worked as strategic analyst at the RAND Corporation, consultant to the Defense Department, by which we mean the War Department, and the White House, specializing in problems of the command and control of nuclear weapons, nuclear war plans, and crisis decision-making. He joined the Defense Department, that's the War Department, in 1964, as special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense, that's war, International Security Affairs John McNaughton, working on Vietnam, or I should say, working over Vietnam, murdering 2 million people over there. He transferred to the State Department in 1965 to serve 2 years at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, evaluating pacification, by which we mean assassination, on the front lines. On the return to the RAND Corporation in 1967, he worked on the top-secret McNamara study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, 1945 through 1968, which later came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. In 1969, he photocopied the 7,000-page study and gave it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In 1971, he gave it to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and 17 other newspapers. Interesting, something I never knew, or assuming it's true, but this is the claim that he actually gave it to the Senate 2 years before he gave it to the New York Times, and of course, he had to risk risk going to jail to reveal it publicly, because apparently the senators didn't feel it was sufficiently either important or they didn't want to take the risk to do it, but he did it 2 years later. They sat on it, in other words, according to this, for 2 years. His trial on 12 felony counts posing a possible sentence of 115 years was dismissed in 1973 on grounds of governmental misconduct against him, which led to the convictions of several White House aides and figured in the impeachment proceedings against our favorite president, who now looks liberal by by contrast, President Nixon. Here's a little of that, and then we'll hear a little more of my standard fare. If you want to call in, you can, 427-3772. If you want to catch me off air, call me at 423-4833.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And now another former employee of the RAND Corporation from a few years further back. It's the American hero, Daniel Ellsberg, liberator of the Pentagon Papers, author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and keeper of the website Ellsberg.net. You can read either there or somewhere. You can read chapter one of his book, Secrets. About the day of the Gulf of Tonkin non-incident, which is incredibly important and interesting. Welcome back to the show, Dan. How are you?
Fine. Glad to be here, Scott.
Good, good. I'm very happy to have you here. Now, this is a very important article that you've written with a co-author, David Krieger, at the Christian Science Monitor, csmonitor.com, for Nuclear Security Beyond Seoul, Eradicate Land-Based Doomsday Missiles, and Seoul refers to the meeting that was held a couple of weeks ago there in Seoul, South Korea. But now the real point is the abolition of intercontinental ballistic missiles. First of all, can you tell us, please, about your co-author, David Krieger? Who's he?
Well, he's the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He's been a leading voice for the abolition of nuclear weapons, keeping that option, trying to put that option on the table, if you like. He was encouraged, of course, by President Obama's taking that as his goal, his ultimate goal, a world free of nuclear weapons, and David Krieger has been pressing that point for over a generation. I must say I wasn't as encouraged by that as David was. I'm an associate. I'm what they call a senior research associate of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. But I wasn't encouraged by that. After all, Reagan announced the same goal. So did Carter, as a matter of fact. People have forgotten that in his inaugural address. And a number of presidents have talked about the abolition of nuclear weapons and done very little about it. And as I see President Obama, so far he's done very little about it, and I remain to be convinced that he's really committed to that.
Mm. Yeah, me too. In fact, his whole big speech there in the Czech Republic, the first half of it was great, and then the second half was about how he didn't really mean it. It was all right there in the speech. In fact, the crowd in the Czech Republic even kind of grew quiet and was like, what?
Yeah.
He said, yeah, this won't happen in our lifetimes, but maybe someday, you know.
The occasion of this, one of the occasions of this op-ed being written, it was written in the aftermath of our having protested. David and I both got arrested protesting the launch.
Well, now, hold on a second, Dan, because I was going to ask you about that. But first, I wanted to recommend to people that they read your series at Truth Dig, all about nuclear weapons. And I wanted to ask you about whether or not you're still working on a book about America's doomsday machine.
Yes, I have a contract with Bloomsbury Press on for a book tentatively entitled The American Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which is what I was back in the 60s, yeah. Early.
And now, the series of articles at Truth Dig are just incredible. I beg everybody to go look at it. They came out in, I think, what, 2010, right?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Okay, now, yes, as you mentioned in this article, I was going to say I gave a talk last week at Brave New Books, and Cindy Sheehan did too, and she mentioned being arrested with you,
right.
Referring to a test at Vandenberg Air Force Base, where you two went to protest and try to shut it down. It was a test of what, Dan?
Of a Minuteman III missile. The our land-based missiles are called Minuteman III. They now have single warheads, although they, by our current arrangements, could go back to multiple warheads as they used to have. We have now 450 of them. There's schedule years from now to get down to perhaps 350. We were wanted to draw attention to the fact that if those things were ever sent off en masse, as they could be on the basis of a false alarm, they would do us as much harm as any Russian retaliation, because the smoke from the burning cities that they would engender would cover the globe, actually, with a stratospheric cover of smoke. This is the old nuclear winter hypothesis, which has been confirmed by recent computer modeling in the last few years very strongly. They would cut out most of the Earth's sunlight, the sunlight we're getting from the sun, and kill the harvest, deprive the Earth of harvest for a number of years. The smoke would last 10 years or more. It would kill years of harvests around the world and starve everyone to death.
Okay, now, included. Could you talk first about, as you do in the article here at csmonitor.com, the incentives, the way it's set up with these missiles in their silos, that a false alarm gives, of just one errant missile maybe, would give the incentive to launch everything we've got. Why is that?
There's two reasons, really, that bear particularly on these land-based missiles. Like the Minuteman III, and the Russians also have land-based missiles, which makes for the worst of situations, because it means that each side has two incentives to launch on a warning, an electronic or infrared warning, that they might be under attack, of which there have been numerous false alarms in the past, some of them lasting for many minutes of the few minutes that are available in order to retaliate. The reason that such a warning presses the leaders of the respective countries to launch their missiles is, in the first instance, that they may be about to lose them. If the warning is valid, if there really is an enemy attack underway, then these land-based missiles are very vulnerable. Few of them will survive a large-scale attack by the other side. So it's use them or lose them. The second reason
with
is...
with very little time to make that choice, whether
right.
You want to use them or lose them.
A handful of minutes, perhaps 12 minutes, out of the 30-minute flight time of the enemy's missiles would be available after lower levels have analyzed the threat, the warning, and eliminated, let's say, a lot of the false warning, the noise that appears every day, practically, and decided that this is really a serious event, a serious warning. Now, the second reason to get them off very fast, and these land-based missiles can be launched within minutes, seconds to minutes, is to attack the enemies, the adversaries' land-based missiles and their command and control before all of those missiles can be launched. Even if the order to launch is given, it's not clear that everything will get off on time, as we know from space events. They don't all take off right away. And the sooner you can get yours off and attack the other side's missiles in its silos, the idea is the less damage you'll suffer from their missiles. You won't have to wait for their missiles to come over. So both to keep your own from being destroyed and to destroy the other side's fixed land-based vulnerable missiles, there's great incentive not to wait any longer, but to get those missiles off and perhaps come out of the war less destroyed than otherwise. Now, an irony is, for the last 50 years, that's basically a delusion. You can't really, that second incentive to destroy the other guy's missiles doesn't really get rid of his submarine-based missiles, which can't be targeted, and those will be enough on either side, especially us against the Soviets, against the Russians, to destroy their society entirely. So the idea of limiting damage has been a kind of hoax, a bluff all this time, and yet it does shape and determine all of our posture, our buying of missiles, our deployment, our training, everything else has been based on this notion that's been a delusion now for half a century, that you could seriously limit your damage by getting in the first strike. The truth is that the first strike will result in as much damage just from retaliation as a second strike. But what we're presenting in this piece is the new data that even without retaliation, the effects of your own strike on burning cities on the other side will be suicidal. Suicidal, and not just to our own country, but to all complex life on Earth.
We got to hold it right there and go out to this break. We're talking with Daniel Ellsberg, the heroic liberator of the Pentagon Papers. He's working on a new book called America's Doomsday Machine about our nuclear weapons stockpiling. He's got this great piece at the CS Monitor for Nuclear Security Beyond Seoul, Eradicate Land-Based Doomsday Missiles. We'll be right back after this. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, liberator of the Pentagon Papers, bringer downer of Richard Nixon, and author of this piece at the Christian Science Monitor for Nuclear Security Beyond Seoul, Eradicate Land-Based Doomsday Missiles. And I want to mention by name here, Hiroshima Day, America has been asleep at the wheel for 64 years. And 100 Holocausts, an insider's window into U.S. nuclear policy. Both of those articles are at Truthdig, part of this project that will culminate in the book Dan is writing, The American Doomsday Machine. And I also see here at your Truthdig bio page, Dan, it says that you wrote this paper, Risk, Ambiguity, and Decision. And this reminds me again that you know, you're not just this peace activist. You're this brilliant war strategist type. You know, you confessed a minute ago into being a former nuclear war planner. And so you understand all this complex game theory and all of these and those kinds of things. And your article at the Christian Science Monitor, if I understand it right, is basically a nice half measure, a modest proposal that let's get rid of the ICBMs. It's easy to say let's just get rid of all nukes, but you're trying to come up with a proposal that policymakers could actually maybe get behind here, that, you know, we'll still have plenty of missiles to blow up the whole world with. Just if we got rid of these kind, we could even keep mutually assured destruction as a strategy, I guess, under your plan. But we would be much less likely to go to war over a mistake, as has almost happened so many times in the past.
Yeah, well said. If these land-based missiles, just on our side alone, the best thing would be for, by all means, to get them off either the Russians or the U.S. The Russians are less likely to do that. They have fewer submarines. They're much less reliable. They don't rely on their submarines. They keep most of them in port most of the time, whereas we keep number at sea all the time. But if we got rid of ours, that would deprive the Soviets. I keep saying that. I'm sorry. lifetime as a cold warrior, the Russians. It would deprive them of targets, essentially, to aim at to try to reduce their damage in a preemptive strike. It would take away the incentive for them to strike on warning of the kind of false, ambiguous warning that they've had a number of times, and thus protect us from their mistake. And at the same time, it would take away the incentive for our man in the Oval Office to launch those missiles to keep them from being destroyed. We would have given them up. The truth is those missiles have been anachronistic, obsolete, unnecessary, and dangerous for over half a century since we acquired submarine missiles that could handle any conceivable targets for us and that were invulnerable for attack. So we should have gotten rid of these things 50 years ago and more. But they continue in part because they provide a small amount of jobs in Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota for the, I take it, the restaurants that serve the people who sit down in these silos much of the time and get ready to turn the key and launch them. They shouldn't be there, and those jobs should be, we would do well to find other work for the people who are servicing those doomsday weapons.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I guess most people would think, I guess just, you know, numbers-wise, you could do the math and figure out maybe American nukes are the most likely to go off in the world just because we have the most, or us and the Russians, but it seems like the most tense nuclear standoff in the world would be India and Pakistan.
The India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
But another point of this very same article, based on recent scientific studies by atmospheric scientists, is that even a relatively small war of 100 Hiroshima-sized weapons, that is, atomic bombs, the kind of weapons that are now the triggers for our H-bombs, for our thermonuclear weapons, 100 of those, and they have more than 100, would cause not the end of life on Earth, but about a billion deaths from starvation, as the effects on the ozone layer and the smoke, which would be less than the overall attack, but enough over time, and again, these effects would last for a decade or more, to reduce harvests all over the world and cause about a billion marginally fed people now to die from starvation. So the rest of the world has a great stake in keeping that war from happening. That is perhaps the most likely, actually deliberate attack to take place in the world, India-Pakistan event. And the fact remains that their few hundreds of weapons are far more than they have a right to threaten the world with in these effects. Well, all the more, of course, then, that's true of the other nuclear states, but above all of the U.S. and the Russia, which have 95% of the warheads, which can, in fact, extinguish life on Earth if we carry out our existing war plans. We have no right to have such a doomsday machine in operation.
Now, if I had asked you the day after Gorbachev resigned whether we would still have this nuclear posture in 2012, what would you have said, do you think?
Well, the day after he resigned would have been a day to worry, to start with, because I believe Gorbachev was the single world leader who, on any side here, who really did understand the apocalyptic aspects of these weapons and was determined to take real action to get rid of them. I should say that what's come out more recently is that Reagan actually had that vision, mm-hmm. but he was so committed to this illusory Star Wars approach, which he could not give up, that he couldn't arrive at a practical moves. Except in a limited way, which he did do with Gorbachev, to move in that direction. But the man who I think really had a very thorough practical grasp of it was Gorbachev, and to lose him was a very serious danger for the human species. I'm not
okay,
sure.
Well, I didn't phrase my question well. After it was pretty clear that, hey, the Cold War is over and we can be friends with the Russians now, once that we were
point. That should have led to a total rethinking of our posture, and unfortunately it just hasn't.
Yeah, it seems like everybody just forgot about it all. If you ask people,
a lot of our weapons, but we still have more than enough left on alert to and subject to false alarm to destroy life on Earth. That's inexcusable. It's outrageous, and it's insane. These sound like, you know, rhetorical overkill here or something, hyperbole. It's not at all. I think if there's ever been an insane policy. It's the nuclear policies that we've both sides have followed for half a century here and more. And in particular, today, with the Cold War over, there isn't the slightest element of strategic rationale for these capabilities for massive destruction to exist.
Yeah, maybe they just need to play the Atomic Cafe on TV more often. We're not ever subjected in popular culture to anti-nuclear propaganda, you know?
It's gone away. People think the problem has been solved since the end of the Cold War. And, of course, the chance of an all-out war between Russia and the U.S. has undoubtedly gone down. The trouble is it hasn't gone down close to zero, and it should be zero, and it isn't. We could easily make it, for example, even without abolishing nuclear weapons altogether, we could easily, in principle here, bring the weapons down in numbers to a level that would not threaten the destruction of civilization, the destruction of life on Earth. That would mean, though, not getting down to where they're talking about now, 1,000 warheads on each side and other thousands in reserve. It would mean getting down to dozens, down to the level, let's say, that China actually has. China right. has a dozen or two dozen intercontinental ballistic missiles.
That's well, and just to try to back you up here, that it's not just hippie beatnik peaceniks like you, Daniel Ellsberg, but it was Robert Gates' own staff just wrote a report in the last couple of years, said, all we need is 14, enough to nuke the capitals of every country who could ever conceivably mess with us.
Really, I'm not sure
all.
I know that study. I'd be glad to hear it. Do you have a reference on that?
I could find it and email it to you for sure, yeah.
Yeah, send it to me. But that would be realistic.
I'll Google it right now and see what I can find.
When the leak occurred, about a month ago, that the Pentagon right now is doing an implementation study for the nuclear posture review that was done a couple of years ago in 2010. So now they're talking about implementing it, and the leak occurred saying that they were considering going down to levels of, on the one hand, 1,100 from the current floor of 1550, going down to perhaps 1,000 or 1,100, or 700 or 800, or 300. Now, I really sat up when I saw that 300. 300 is actually still enough on the edge, if targeted on cities, to destroy life on Earth. So it's still too many for any nation to have. But nevertheless, that's a serious reduction that would make a difference. Fact. Whereas going down to 1,000 essentially doesn't make a difference. That's what we're likely to do. 1,000 is still far more than is needed to cause a nuclear winter. And to have those on both sides is inexcusable. And that's where they're likely to come out. But when the 300 was mentioned, the Republicans just rose as a body and used phrases like reckless lunacy to think of this. Well, I was kind of glad to see that phrase get into circulation because, as a part of serious discussion here, because it really is a good characterization of our actual policy this year and every year in the past for the last 50. Reckless lunacy is a good way to describe it. So I'm glad that's in polite usage now. But they were saying, no, 300 would be reckless lunacy. We need thousands, 1,000 or more.
Right.
We need far more than is needed to destroy life on Earth. 300 can just marginally do that.
Yeah. Now, well, I'm sorry I was not able to pull up the report or an article on this report right offhand, but I'm positive I did not make this up, so I'm going to find a footnote and send it on to you. But it was, I believe it was the Office of the Secretary of Defense, people working directly for Gates who had put out this report, saying we only need 14.
Well, that's in the, let me say that Herb York, who was the first director of Livermore Labs, which was put up to pursue Teller's dream of thermonuclear weapons and to compete with Los Alamos, he was the first director of Livermore Labs and then later director of research and engineering in the Defense Department and a major arms negotiator later. He wrote a piece for Livermore on what the real requirements for deterrence were. And he said you could go at it from two directions. On the one hand, how many warheads does it really take to deter another country from attacking you. He could have said, for example, how many would Saddam have needed to keep us from attacking him in either the Gulf War or the, if he'd had them, if he'd had any, which he didn't, in 2003. How many would he have needed? Would he need 1,000? No. He suggested 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 10 in case, you know, they were able to lose in case he couldn't guarantee that he could, some of them would survive. So you might want as many as 10 to deter. North Korea has tens, if any. We're not sure really what they have in the way of weapons, but they might have as many as 10 or so. Even George W. Bush stopped talking about attacking North Korea while he was focused on Iraq. North Korea went ahead and tested weapons and actually acquired some. On the other hand, York said, what if you went from another direction and said, what is the maximum number of deaths you would want one world leader to be able to cause in a short time? He said, supposing, that's a question rarely asked or never asked. He said, supposing you thought that the most they should be able to cause in the way of fatalities would be something like the total deaths of World War II. Something between 40 and 60 million. That would be, you didn't want any one human to have more power than that. He said, well, that would mean about 100 warheads. He said, at the very utmost, 200, but really 100. He said, from this point of view, York said, something, the requirements for deterring attack would be somewhere from 1 to 10 to 100 and closer to 1 than 100. And here you would have what you're suggesting is the Gates people were on that line, something 10 or 14 or something like that. That's not crazy at all. In fact, that's the way in which China has actually based its deterrent policy. They were far less insane in that than the U.S. or Russia with the thousands, the tens of thousands that they came to acquire. The fact remains that anybody should be asked, what would be the target, say, for the 300 weapons that France may have now, or a couple hundred, or Israel probably has 200 to 300, if not more. What are the targets for those, and what would the environmental impact be of sending those off? Would it be destroying most of life on Earth, or if they weren't all targeted on cities, what exactly would it be, half a billion, a billion people? How could this be conceivably justified? And yet this is the state of reckless lunacy that the human species has gotten itself into.
On a not all that minor, but somewhat minor point there, since you mentioned it, I wanted to ask you about what you said about Israel there. I believe, because I've quoted you, this is why I remember it. I don't actually remember you saying it. I remember me saying that you said it before.
And we're going to pause briefly because we have a breaking report from our roving reporter, Steadfast Steve Plaich. Hello, Steve Plaich. Come in.
Ah, how are my good friends at Free Radio today? I just came from the Santa Cruz, Occupy Santa Cruz General Assembly, which is just adjourned, but I myself... I'm taking autonomous action. I am occupying San Lorenzo Park. Come join me.
You are occupying the park. Are you doing this? But wait, it's not after curfew. It's not after dark. How can this be called an occupation?
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I'm not occupying. Well, anyway, I'm standing at the site of our former Occupy San Lorenzo Park, where we had 60 glorious days, if you recall, during October, November this year.
Indeed, and you were involved actually in a lawsuit. In fact, you still have your finger in the pie, so to speak, in a lawsuit trying to respond to the attempts of Dennett Shoemaker and City Attorney John Barasoni to crush that occupation. They, of course, did send in the Santa Cruz Police Department to do just that.
Well, that lawsuit is still pending, and I really intend to litigate that and maybe go to trial with that this summer. I would love to see... Occupy Santa Cruz, and particularly Occupy San Lorenzo Park, have it today in court, which we weren't, allowed to have because of the dismantling of the camp, the sudden dismantling of the camp following the evacuation notice in early December.
Now, the actual issues of that lawsuit, and this has come up a number of times kind of in passing at the General Assemblies, which happen four times a week, sort of, every mm-hmm. so often,
yeah.
Has been whether this is not simply, as Attorney Ed Fry has said, and he's, of course, the official attorney for the non-existent Occupy Santa Cruz, by the which I mean not so much it doesn't come together as a group, but Occupy Santa Cruz has never really liked and been comfortable with calling itself any kind of corporate organization of any kind.
What we decided when we were actually sued and then filed a cross complaint was Occupy Santa Cruz is actually an unincorporated association, so it is a legal entity. But Ed, I think, sees the merit in our cross complaint. When we were sued, the gravamen of the city's complaint was that this was a public nuisance and it must be abated through an order from the court. And we said, no, it is not a public nuisance. Actually, we're conferring a public benefit. And there are significant First Amendment freedom of speech and freedom of assembly constitutional rights that must be litigated. And those have not gone away.
What if, I mean, of course, we know that the police by force destroyed the campground, sent, truck after truck of piled with tents and to some extent some leftover trash for sure to the city dump or the landfill, whatever. And then for about two or three months, I'm not sure how long, there was a fenced off mesh around that part of the park that homeless people, 100 to 200 of them, had used, having no other place to go. That is both a kind of a refuge and also as a staging area for protests around the Occupy Santa Cruz issues. Let's suppose, I mean, is there any, what issues now remain? Let's suppose you won the lawsuit. What impact would that have on, let's say, the ability of people to reoccupy that area, or to, I might even say, to join you in your lone occupation right now?
Yet another lonely vigil. I don't know, Robert, tell you the truth. I mean, I think that whether or not San Lorenzo Park is a traditional public forum, and I believe that it is, and so if it is designated by the court, held to be a traditional public forum, then certainly the exercise of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and the restriction of that comes under greater scrutiny by any subsequent court decision. So that's kind of what we would like the court to say is, yes, San Lorenzo Park is a traditional public forum. Yes, it's a place where people can go and remain to express their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and to freely assemble and to assemble without restrictions for time, place, and manner, which, as you know, are placed on all freedom of speech and freedom of assembly rights.
Well, you're saying without restrictions for time, place, and manner, is that, wouldn't that be sort of a radical and revolutionary change which would, has not been held to be in effect for any, even full public forums? You can't, it's appropriate to regulate time, place, and manner for any public forum, even, I don't know, the sidewalks and parks, which according to some Supreme Court in the 30s, I think they were fanciful, said, from time immemorial has been a refuge for free speech and all that sort of thing.
Well, all I'm saying is that Occupy Santa Cruz, San Lorenzo Park deserves to have its day in court, and I think it would be valuable for the community to have everybody appear in court and make their feelings plain about what is the traditional public forum, what is a reasonable regulation of place, time, and manner in our community. Let's see what our community values are. And regardless of whether we receive the kind of adjudication or decision that we would like to have, at least it would be an opportunity for everybody to stand up and speak out about that in a court of jurisdiction in San Cruz County.
Well, as I understand it, the issue was thrown into federal court successfully and then has been bounced back into the local state/county court. It's the state court, but it's in the county, at the county,
we're back,
the DA covers that.
In front of Judge Folkman again, but that doesn't diminish in any way the issues that are before the court. We would rather have had those litigated in federal court because we thought there was more appropriate forum for constitutional issues, but they're just as able to litigate and decide constitutional issues here in our Superior Court as they are in federal court.
Well, wasn't Judge Volkman the costumed clown, if you'll forgive the inappropriate and disrespectful characterization, who okayed the police to go in and crush the campground on December 7th? Actually, they went on the 8th, but I guess the court decision was either the 6th or the 7th of last year, when the Danette Shoemaker declared there was an imminent emergency for an evacuation order or some such thing. And though she wasn't quite clear into what she meant by that, since neither fire, flood, hurricane, nor tigers were loose in the park at that time, the issue was sort of decided. What new? I guess you would regard it simply as a forum for further discussion.
Well, the issue wasn't decided, and I wouldn't characterize Judge Volkman as anything but an honorable representative of our local court system. But he gave us, by his lights anyway, a fair hearing on whether or not we could prove, support any of the four elements of the preliminary injunction that we requested. And he found that we couldn't. Now, he didn't make any necessarily determination about the existence of public nuisance or whether or not the characterizations by Parks and Rec were accurate. He simply said that our papers were insufficient in his mind to make it likely that we would succeed on the merits of our underlying lawsuit. So that it was more of a procedural hearing than anything else, and really no substantive issues in terms of whether or not there was a public nuisance or whether or not it's a reasonable restriction of place, time, and manner in the park were really decided.
Let's suppose that, well, first of all, where are we in terms of this lawsuit? I mean, is there a hearing coming up, or will you
No,
be...
well, that, the underlying lawsuit in which we based our preliminary injunction request was actually against the city and the police department, and that probably will be dismissed because that's just Occupy Santa Cruz, not me, and I think the sense of Occupy Santa Cruz is that
I've got to tell you, Steve, you're fading out. So maybe you need to either talk more loudly or get a better phone or possibly come into the studio.
How am I doing now?
Better.
That's better?
Better.
I'm moving into a better cell zone. No, because Occupy Santa Cruz really hasn't been able to resource another attorney, and Ed just doesn't have the time to litigate that particular lawsuit and the one that I'm a party to, I think that the lawsuit's going to be dismissed, so we'll just have the one original lawsuit that sued Occupy Santa Cruz and myself individually, and that's the one that we'll take to court in the summer.
Well, not only do you speak in a rapid and, shall we say, rich and fact-filled manner that may leave some gasping for breath, but again, the problem is that we have difficult transmission difficulty here.
Oh, okay, well, I just wanted to call in and let you know that the General Assembly has adjourned, that I'm adjourning probably downtown to relax a bit myself, and we will probably be talking to you soon about any number of issues.
Well, I know that I've received a secret email from you, which I shall not disclose to man or dog, but the question is, are you... I know that you've also been involved in other organizations like the DSAL and the ACLU. Do you have anything you wish to reveal about their behaviors or activities at this time?
Well, I can tell your listeners that the ACLU did vote to and has sent a letter to Northern California ACLU requesting that they submit a letter brief on behalf of the 11 defendants in the Santa Cruz 75 River Street prosecution. Until they receive that and make some comment on it, I would really am not at liberty to tell you what the contents of it are. But that's the substance of what we have done. Now, we're also drafting a strong, I hope will be, a strong letter of support for the 75 River Street defendants, and that's being drafted by our vice chair, Jen Laskin. And that's in the process of being prepared. So I am hoping that that strong statement of support will also include individually, I would be hoping that would include a request, a demand for dismissal of all charges in the interest of justice. But right now, we're still working out the draft of the letter, and Jen's working on it, and the board's working on it. So I really don't have anything further to report, except to say that the ACLU has been supportive of Occupy Santa Cruz, and the ACLU at this point is supportive of any help that the Northern California ACLU can give to the 75 River Street defendants.
Okie dokie. Any meetings coming up we should know about?
Well, there's a bunch of stuff. Oh, interestingly, for tomorrow is Women in Black. Oh, Occupy Art will be at the 612 Ocean Street Resource Center for Nonviolence tomorrow. Ayla Hefferman and all the folks from Occupy Santa Cruz will be
displaying their art things at the 7 o'clock.
This is Occupy Art, the art of, shall we say, engaging in finger painting rather than a meaningful occupation, that sort of thing?
Finger painting rather than finger poking, I would characterize it.
I see.
You know what I mean? Or finger pointing, as you so often.
Finger pointing, yes. Well put.
On Saturday, of course, there's a VA at the post office at 2 o'clock, but I'll be out at Mitchell Cove. We're having a DSAL walkthrough tomorrow with five former mayors. Your old pals, Chris Crone, Bruce Van Allen, Jane Weed Pomerantz, Tim Fitzmorris, and Celia Scott will all be there, along with former supervisor, chair of the supervisors, in fact, Gary Patton, talking about the proposed DSAL plant out of Mitchell Cove. We'll be there at 3 o'clock. Should be
That's
fun.
The
We're gonna have
$130 million boondoggle you're talking about?
The very one.
Mm.
The very one. So that's exciting, and that'll be happening. And there's, you know, any number of things that are going on, but those are just a couple.
Well, Steve, thank you. And I know, of course, the Homeless Legal Persons Assistance Project, HOLP, as some people have never called it, happens every Wednesday now. At the same time, it's subverting the HUF, Homeless
right,
United
there,
for
yeah.
Friendship and Freedom meeting, which happens at the same time at the Sub Rosa. You meet with yep. folks out at, well, I guess you meet at the Red Church on Monday evenings, 5 to 7.
I'm there at 5 to 7 as well. Gary Johnson, bless his heart, and Free Gary Johnson, used to call it HEPLAP. So.
HEPLAP, indeed. Homeless Legal Assistance Project. Homeless Persons
right.
Assistance Project.
And so, you know, we just, as you know, we just had a meeting, Homeless Project, Homeless Connect coming up. I'm sure HUF will be tabling this year as they did last year.
Trying to.
Okay, there
Probably.
You go. You'll be swathed in your bathrobe with Teddy at the belt, ready to go.
Well, that depends on whether she, he, or I should say, the. Well, this will be he, or but there he has numerous brothers. There is Teddy 1, Teddy 2, Teddy 3. They, the question of whether they will make it past the court is always an issue, because judges seem to, well, have a certain distaste for teddy bears and things of that sort.
And there's some other interesting developments that came up, in fact, that the Association of Faith Communities meeting that I just attended.
Steve, talk a bit closer to the phone, could you?
And I'll tell you about that. You can hear me better now?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that. We were discussing a couple of things before, during, and after the Association of Faith Communities meeting over at the Red Church this evening. And there are a couple of things, actually, that I'll talk to you offline about, because I'll need your help and worldly knowledge about some things that we might want to do in terms of homeless activities here and helping people who have some problems with food court. So,
well, for your benefit and for the benefit of any DAs listening, I will be probably at Joe's Pizza at 8:10 and maybe approachable at that point.
Perhaps we'll see you then. All right.
All right, then.
Take it.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM and an undetermined place at the internet stream, should you be able to find. I think if you go to FRSC audio stream and click around, you'll find something. But and you can call me on the HUF line at 423-HUF, 423-4833, and I will not only point you in the right direction, but give you the exact specifics of a couple of streams you can go to. But unfortunately, talking about them on the air is just too lengthy, and nobody has any pencils ready, or at least I haven't heard that they do. I'm going to take a musical break. I'll be right back. And remember, don't go away unless you feel like it. And that's another one by Sarah Marlowe from Times Like These. That particular selection is called Not As They Know. It's called Only Starlight. Sorry. Okay, we have in the studio with us poet extraordinaire and man about the courts, Madcap Mitch. Hey, Mitch, say hello.
Oh, just call me the Big Lebowski when I'm wearing my my green bathrobe. But we don't have a singing and dancing number yet, do we?
You don't have your bathrobe with you there, Mitch.
Should I get a tap dancing cane?
No, you're doing fine. I see you have your saber-tooth tiger necklace around your neck there.
This was given to me by a Hopi medicine woman. I have to confess that although it is a beautiful color and it's clearly from the crustacean world, it makes me want to bite something's head off. I observed that. But I have a one-minute reading.
Which you'll be repeating at the Sub Rosa Cafe tonight at 8, right?
This came to me in the last Shiva moon on the 26th of March 2012. I called it Peace, Hypocrite. Mm-hmm. Peace, hypocrite. You don't practice what you preach. Peace, hypocrite. You couldn't tell a turd from a peach. Peace, hypocrite. You're a disgrace to all things beach. Peace, hypocrite. Peace hypocrite can't remember how to smoke a peace pipe. Peace hypocrite can't remember a single movie with a lead pipe. Peace hypocrite won't know if Christmas has a Valentine's Day love pipe. Peace hypocrite. Peace hypocrite will, one way or another, preach what they actually practice. Peace hypocrite will learn from Orion. Peace hypocrite will learn from Aztec moon goddesses. Peace hypocrite will become a humble primate. Peace hypocrite will be either a moth or butterfly, depending on their inner worm. Peace hypocrite. Peace hypocrite. Peace hypocrite.
Thank you, Mitch, and we'll hear you again. If you want to hear another more by Mitch, check him out at the Sub Rosa Cafe. He'll be there, and no doubt at other spots as well.
Joe's Pizza at 8 o'clock.
And we'll see you there. Take care, Mitch.
Excellent.
And that's a sometime Huff meeting attender and a man who writes poetry and reads it. So you can check him out, too. Also, if you want to have your own thoughts to put forward in a public forum, you can do that at the Sub Rosa. That's at 8 o'clock every Thursday night, I believe. It might even be earlier, but I don't know. It is happening at 8 o'clock. So keep that in mind. We're continuing here at 101.3 FM. In case you have some call-in thoughts, 427-3772, 427-3772, or our alternate number, 469-3119, 469-3119. Again, if you want to talk to me privately and personally, you can call me at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833. We had a sort of a Huff meets every Wednesday, as I've mentioned before, endlessly. And actually, the meetings seem to be getting bigger. A lot of Occupy folks, or a number of Occupy folks, seem to be trickling in or kind of sometimes even flooding into the meeting. We, at the encouragement of one of our activists a week before, we kind of tentatively scheduled a protest in front of the Wells Fargo Bank at 74 River Street, which is across the street from the famous vacant bank building at 75 River Street, formerly the Coast Commercial Bank. And that was the bank that was occupied by several hundred people on and off over a period of 3 days as part of a demonstration, as I understand it, from the documentation I read and from the interviews I did with people to establish a community center, find a place perhaps for homeless people to be, sleep, engage in activity, and also to protest the corporate corruption and thievery of Wells Fargo Bank, the largest foreclosure artist in the nation, and the bank right across the street who owns the lease to the vacant building that was occupied for 3 days. And a lot of people came in and out of that bank, and they charged 11 people. I'm one of the 11 charged with felonies, not just for allegedly trespassing on property that had been vacant and unused for 3.5 years and is now surrounded by a fence that's covered with barbed wire. The symbolism is interesting. but also vandalism, because there was some graffiti found, and there was some minor damage, as I understand it, from police reports that was done. But I think Wells Fargo came out with a very inflated figure of $30,000, which I'm still hoping to see the videos that the police, I believe, took during that period of time. And the videos don't seem to be showing up. The attorneys I've talked to, including my own attorney, has not been able to secure any video footage whatsoever from District Attorney Rebecca Young, who is putting a lot of the district attorney's time and energy into a very fear-ridden campaign against 11 people, none of whom, to my knowledge, as I understand it, are in any way, you know, the central organizers of any of this activity, or maybe not even been guilty of even the most minor of the charges, though I guess it depends on how you define trespass. So there's a lot of controversy around this case. I've talked about it on the radio a lot. I'll be talking about it a lot more. I'm a little tired tonight, so in case you hear me fumbling about, that's my excuse. But pay attention to the words rather than how they fumble bumble out of my mouth. This protest yesterday, I guess it was, it was Wednesday, was quite successful. We'd had previously a protest on February 15th, which had about two or three times as many people. The bank actually closed down, as we understand it. The police came over and began harassing protesters, grilling reporters and journalists. And that's, of course, part of the whole strategy, it seems, of these indictments, these felonies that are being charged. They're charging these felonies against reporters and bloggers who were whose main role, it seemed like, in this in the eyes at least of the district attorney, was to who wrote about this protest and ways that the police chief, district attorney, other officials didn't like. Although, again, you know, I can't really speak ultimately to the motives of the district attorney. Bob Lee does not confide in me, much as I occasionally have this little chat with him in the elevator every so often. That's true. I actually run into him in the county building when I'm there forced to go to court because of his false and cooked-up charges. Anyway, the protests were really attempted to refocus the attention of the community on what the real issues are, which don't really have much to do with people being prosecuted, other than that shows sort of the nervousness of authorities or the depth of sort of anger of the authorities at their authority being challenged, their determination to fight the rising tide of dissatisfaction with repression and fear, which is a standard kind of tool that authorities use when they're being challenged, particularly by whistleblowers like the 75 River Street whistleblowers, of whom there were hundreds. And some weren't really whistleblowers. They were just observers who came in to see what was going on. But if there were to be a fair prosecution, every single person who walked in that building would be ridiculously charged. And, of course, that would appear to the community to be completely ridiculous. So this seems to be an occasion for them to go after people that I suspect for other reasons they don't like the, I don't know if it's the way they dress or the tone of their voice, but it's probably what we say and do in terms of criticizing public officials and raising public consciousness in ways that are not very respectful of existing authority. But you know, for existing authority to be respected, it must be respect worthy. And, of course, we found over the last few decades that that just is not the case. And that's the problem. The problem is how to create new institutions, to create new modes of relating between people that involve not only respect, but also involve love and involve a true understanding and a true appreciation of each other's needs. Anyway, so there we were at Wells Fargo Bank trying to raise the issue of, we actually were doing polling, asking who had problems at Wells Fargo Bank, or perhaps alternately who liked Wells Fargo Bank, also who had knowledge of the prosecutions by District Attorney Bob Lee of against 11 members of the community. essentially, as I said, for exposing these issues, whether by reporting on them or by, with hundreds of others, creating awareness of them through the occupation of a vacant building, which has been done a number of times in a number of other cities with nowhere near the draconian and abusive results here in Santa Cruz. I mean, the police would do come in and they've arrested people, but in this occupation in Santa Cruz, people left peacefully. And I believe none of the people who left peacefully that I'm aware of are even charged, although I wasn't there when the people left. The people, from what I see in terms of the documentation by the police reports, people charged, well, it's hard to say. I don't have a complete recollection. There's 103 pages of police reports. But I have yet to be convinced that any of the people charged were continuous, long-time occupiers at that building. Or in any central way, organizers of the occupation, they seem to have been singled out for maybe for the convenience of the police because the police didn't bother to identify other people. All the police reports are they're limited to they end at the middle of December. The occupation itself happened at the end of November and early December. So there doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot of actual investigation done, in spite of a big brouhaha raised in the media. And it's this protest was quite a kind of a merry affair. We had a lot of signs. We had flyers we were giving out, which you can find described on indiebay.org, Santa Cruz Indie Media. And it may become a regular event. It's not quite clear. There seemed to be some enthusiasm about repeating this. And I think the issue of Wells Fargo is a much more important issue, even than the defense of the what I've called the Santa Cruz 11, of which I'm one. Because Wells Fargo is going to have long-ranging impact, and has had long-ranging impact, on millions, if not tens of millions of people in this country, and many people in this community. And you can actually go to the Sentinel and find stories about people who have been ripped off by Wells Fargo and its deceptive practices, specifically around foreclosure, but also around fees and costs and when they charge, when they will, the way they handle their checking accounts and when they withdraw funds and how much they charge you for overdrafts, policies that are designed to create their maximum profit and put people who are not in the best financial position in a far worse position. In any case, I encourage people to keep your eyes on the Indie Bay page, Santa Cruz Indie Media, for forthcoming protests. They will be happening, I'm fairly sure. And there's... My goodness, there sounds like someone's calling in even now on a very loud line. Let's see what's being said here. Or what will be said. Yo, you're on free radio.
I'm on free?
You are on free radio,
hey,
sir.
Hey, Uncle Robert, it's David.
Hello there, David. Silva, I believe.
So, you know, I went to a veterans meeting this week and found out that the VASHs are going to be released in May instead of August. So if there's any homeless people, the homeless veterans out there who had their VASH applications and we're just sort of letting them slack and not in touch with their veterans rep, get in touch with them right away.
David, clarify what you mean. I don't understand what you're talking about.
Well, the Obama administration, when they first came into office, set a goal that there'll be no more veterans homelessness after 2015.
Uh-huh.
And to accomplish that goal, you have to reach so many, get so many people housed each year. So there's the Veterans Administration is giving money to the Housing Authority to give the vouchers, but with much more liberal parameters so that veterans aren't penalized for just being veterans.
Okay.
Yeah, and so it's really quite a big campaign, and it's been going on bigger every year. And this year, it's going to come 4 months earlier, and it's going to be twice as many. So if there's homeless veterans out there that just thought, oh, I have to wait till August before I can even hear anything about it, know that, no, it's earlier this year.
So how can veterans, homeless vets, get more information about this?
Well, just call the county veterans rep. You can go to Building K and ask for a veterans rep. Go to Building E on Wednesday at 9:30 in the morning, and there's just all the veteran service officers are ready there to help you with all kinds of everything, dental care, everything, back-to-work care, you know, everything like that.
That's every morning or just once a week?
No, Wednesday morning specific, but Monday through Thursday, there'll be some veterans rep there as always. But Building E is that Wednesday morning. Also in Capitola on 41st and Brommer, the Veterans Building there, every Wednesday afternoon at 1, there's a very, very good high information meeting there that they can get you on board. Make sure you sign up with the right veterans reps because there's all kinds of programs now coming out for veterans.
Well, that sounds great. Is there any online place people can go to?
I'm sure there is, and, you know, I'll check that out for you and call back if I can in time, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, Uncle Robert, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's our man around the vet's office, David Silva, who has been a longtime activist in Santa Cruz during the 90s, and he's returned recently. He was homeless for quite a period of time and really got a kind of the bloody taste of what it's like to be homeless in Santa Cruz. And he's talked about that on the air as well. Recently, he, I think, is losing his lodging in part because of associations with a member of the Santa Cruz 11, whom the landlord may be discriminating against by cutting short the rental opportunity there, even though that person is paying rent faithfully. That's one of the consequences of this kind of malicious prosecution that is being done by Lee's office. Decent activists are being not just frightened and muzzled, but they're losing work. A teacher's credentials are being delayed, so at least two individuals I know who are part of the 11 aren't getting their credentials, so they can't continue teaching, as I understand it. One has attempted suicide. There's, at least one is being forced out of the rental arrangement. All this is happening based on, and it's not clear whether Wells Fargo initiated this or the police went over to Wells Fargo in order to pressure activists who are in the vacant building to leave, but there was a trespass complaint, which ultimately the protesters, I don't know if the proper word is respected, but they certainly left the building. And that being the case, nonetheless, 2.5 months later, you get this nasty, retaliatory, selective prosecution, which is seriously impacting, if not ruining, lives. And it's something the news media is not really covering. There is some coverage of two of the 11, Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart, who are longtime Indy Bay journalists. Actually, I'm a longer time Indy Bay journalist than one of them, but certainly journalists. There are a number of us who have been writing regularly, and that was really one of our major functions in that, if not our major function in that whole episode. Although there have been many protests, and many people have been supportive of protests. That doesn't mean supportive necessarily of illegal activity, but certainly supportive of protests. And in some cases, it may have meant supportive of civil disobedience, but never a felonious vandalism. I don't think anybody in this group has ever done that. That's the smear label being used to persuade the public somehow that this rather nasty case, which, as I understand it, as I said, 8 years in a flyer, but it's actually 7 years in prison, if my information is correct, is the possible penalty, if not more, that each of us is facing in these prosecutions. If anybody's interested in more information, you can go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz to get more info about this, Santa Cruz Indy Media. Again, look for our stories under my name, which is Robert Norse, N-O-R-S-E, and there are stories by other activists as well around this. Journalists committee, reporters committees have come out with statements denouncing these prosecutions. It sounds like from what Steve Plaisch said, the ACLU locally for the first time in its life, or at least in recent memory, is going to come out with something addressing local civil liberties, or the lack of the crackdown on local civil liberties. So my commendations to them for doing that. Let me turn now to another issue that was raised by some Occupy Santa Cruz activists recently, a long-term issue that, as I said, Wells Fargo seems to be one of the chief unindicted criminals in the midst of, the foreclosure fraud crisis that is continuing, and it hasn't gotten any better. It's continuing to, I don't have the figures on how whether it's escalating sharply or even escalating at all, but the level at which it's continuing is not indicated it's going away. Here's some Occupy Santa Cruz activists, myself included, have gone to the Board of Supervisors to raise issues, and I don't think I've played this before. This was from early March. Here's some speeches at the Board of Supes. Coming up shortly. Oh, or at least I'm hoping it's coming up shortly. Having some technical difficulties, my apologies. Let's see if I can make this work with another machine. I have a somewhat primitive technology, as those who know me like to point out, but let's see how this works. There we go.
Members of the Board of Supervisors and the community, I want to invite everyone in the community, including the board, including Susan Mariello, who has banned everybody from the entire public from this area after 7 o'clock at night, to join a march to encourage Sheriff Wowak on March 11th, Sunday, to stop the foreclosures. That's going to start at 1 p.m. at the courthouse steps. It's going to feature the Raging Grannies, if you'd like to sing or you appreciate listening to folks try to sing, myself included. The street theater, there's going to be a stops at banks to encourage banks when they're closed to perhaps the community be aware of those banks. They're the primary culprits here locally as well as nationally. There'll be inspirational speakers, signs. There'll be chants and drums. You can bring your own instrument. There'll be a moderator training and mediation at 12:30, half an hour before the 1 p.m. Sunday march. Sponsors include Occupy Santa Cruz Foreclosure Working Group, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Brown Berets, Resource Center for Nonviolence, Occupy Monterey, Occupy Cabrillo, and the UCSC General Assembly. This is to fight foreclosure fraud, which is a subject that has been brought up a lot. I know that your power may be somewhat limited in this situation, but certainly you can issue public statements on this. You can try to support the sheriff's action. You can consider the recommendations made by the various speakers on foreclosure to you. The foreclosure working group meets every Saturday at 4 p.m. if any of you want to join that group. That includes any member of the public. And I also want to again raise the issue here because we are concerned that 11 of us are charged for essentially peaceful First Amendment activity and reporting in a case that continues to drag on and will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars involving the peaceful occupation of a vacant bank building leased by Wells Fargo, and that is at 75 River Street. It's something that the district attorney is spending a lot of money on. Again, that's independent of you, but I think it's an issue that's a very important community concern, how these dollars are spent and what your position is on the issues underlying the kind of protests, peaceful protests, that involve hundreds of people. Only 11 of us are charged. That protest involved acknowledging that there are vacant structures throughout the city, 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people throughout the city, and banks and other large corporations that keep those buildings and properties vacant for their own personal profit, to the disgrace of the city and to the disadvantage of the people who really need some kind of shelter during the winter. Thank you. I'm Robert Norris, and I can be reached online if you want to talk to me or any of the occupation group. I do not speak for Occupy Santa Cruz, but only for myself, by the way.
Good morning. My name is Ken Foster, and I spoke with you a while ago about my situation. I wanted to give you a few more details and invite you over to my place. I don't need a bunch of people crying crocodile tears for a 50-year-old man losing his house, but I do want
to stop foreclosure fraud. And I think in this community, we really need to open our eyes and see what we can do to stop this. When the economy went south 3 years ago or so, and my business was flatlined. I started paying payroll instead of mortgage, and I did that for about 4 months. Advice universally was don't start paying your mortgage again until you have a loan modification. And so 24 months later, I had reapplied and applied and reapplied for the loan modification. And my last time that I applied for the loan modification, I had proof of HUD funding for my father, Herb Foster, who has Alzheimer's, to live in my house, and proof of profit from my business. And Chase said they accepted my loan modification, my bank, but their investor said they don't even do loan modification. After 24 months, they told me they don't even do loan modification. And 5 days before the trustee sale that was set in November of 2011, they told me that they denied my loan modification. And then they moved the trustee sale date to December, January, and February, and now it's set for March. Last month, we had a stop foreclosure teach-in at my house. And I want to invite you all to my place. It's on the Facebook as New Earth Homestead, and it's a demonstration for permaculture. And I'd love to have you all over for a tour. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. Hi, I'm Becky Johnson. I'm one of the Santa Cruz 11, and I'm currently falsely charged with two felonies and two misdemeanors, which has completely messed up my life and deprived me of an ability to earn a living. But I'm not here to talk to you about my case. I'm here to talk to you about the case of Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson is a homeless man. He's no relation to me. He has been opposing the Santa Cruz sleeping ban, the law, municipal code 6.36.010. Section A disallows sleeping between the hours of 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. anywhere outdoors or in a legally parked and licensed vehicle. Section B bans the use of a blanket between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. anywhere outdoors. There is an exception, of course, for use of a blanket between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. inside a vehicle. And, of course, because house people sometimes like to stay warm in their vehicle after 11 p.m. We have two sets of rules, one for housed and one for homeless. And Gary Johnson has literally put his body on the line, laying out every night in the free speech zone, and you do have one. Maybe you're not aware of it, but you have one. It's a limited public forum. And he's laid his body down there in violation, direct violation of those laws and to protest those laws. And he has asserted his right to protest 24/7. Apparently, certain parties in this county building here believe that the First Amendment only applies between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And apparently this has gone into effect without a peep of protest by the five of you. Personally, if my First Amendment were at risk, I would be more like Gary if I had enough courage, which I don't. He's had the courage to come back again and again, including being arrested, dragged off in chains, finally released, and coming back and laying his body down again in the free speech zone to assert his right to protest 24/7 and to sleep at night.
Good
ahead, Marilyn. Good morning, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the board. My name is Ed Kramer. I'm in Pleasant Point. And I'm here specifically to address the smart meter problem. It's not a smart meter. It's been misnamed. It's nothing to do with smart. It's pretty insidious. But I participated in the opt-out program, which is offered by PG&E. I paid the fee, and I got my meter removed, and I had an analog installed. And it made almost no difference whatsoever. If there was a slight improvement, it was quite negligible. It'd be like as if this room had 1,000 barking dogs in it, and 5% of those dogs were removed. Like 50 barking dogs were removed. You still had 950 barking dogs. It wouldn't make any difference if 5% were removed. And that might be what removing the electric smart meter did. And removing the gas smart meter might have made more of a difference. But there still are the repeater stations. And these things keep in constant contact, even though PG&E will swear they only broadcast 5 seconds every 2 or 3 hours. They broadcast on a continual basis. They broadcast these zeros. It's called chatter. And they keep this chatter up so that they keep their lines open. And this stuff is it's really bad news. And it affects quite a few people, even though the statistics only say 3 to 5% of the people are affected by it. Those are the 3 or 5% that are aware that they're being affected by it. There are probably many, many more percentages of people that are not aware that they're being affected. And I urge you to please ask PG&E to stop this whole smart grid business, the smart meters. It's just definitely not right. We didn't ask for it. The EIR, there was no EIR done. Our county health official found these things to be pretty hazardous. The article in Gentleman's Quarterly, February of 2010, talks about the effect of this radiation. I went up to the California PUC up in San Francisco, and here at my 3-minute oral communication, those people were getting 1-minute oral communications. There was about 100 people lined up, all talking about the complaints they had with the smart meter program all across the state. So I understand that you folks know that there is a major problem. I'm just asking you to please try to do something to stop this smart meter program in this county. We have a moratorium. We've renewed the moratorium. And it would be nice if some action could be taken, if we can get a judge to do an injunction against PG&E for having these things in our county. So thank you very much. I sincerely appreciate everything that you can do, that you possibly can do. And excuse me if my train of thought is a little bit disrupted. I'm going through sleep deprivation and all the problems of not being able to sleep because of these smart meters. And actually, it would be preferable if it were barking dogs, because I could put earplugs in my ears. But the smart meters, you can't put earplugs in ears for smart meters, because that stuff goes right through the side of your head. It goes through the skull. So you're quite welcome. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. Discussion here of criminal negligence and crimes. And what you've heard from about the foreclosures is indeed huge crime. And people are driven from their homes because of the smart meter and other radiation, and become part of a homeless population and sleeping in their parks. And I urge you to follow the direction of the people here and immediately calling for a moratorium on foreclosures. And this is another crime I want to address, is the radiation. I keep thinking of this book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies in the Public Relations Industry. Well, you can say toxic radiation is good for you, lies, damn lies in the public relations industry. Whether it's from the Wi-Fi in this building, which makes my tremors worse, or from cell towers or cell phones, it's all a health hazard, and it's harming animals too. In this room here, last Friday, on the 3rd of March, I went to a zoning administrator meeting, And I requested that the zoning administrator continue item 2 on the agenda, which was a proposal to mount 3 LTE antennas. That stands for the euphemism long-term evolution. It's for more radiation-emitting antennas that enable the smart technology of the smartphones to work. And the reasons were for inaccuracies in the staff report. Of course, it was rubber stamp approved, like it always these radiation emitting antennas are. So there were inaccuracies in the staff report. I'd like you to take this up in an appeal. The relevance of the county health official's January 24th report, which I attach, health risks associated with smart meters, and it deals with other technologies. I put that in brackets. And evidence that this radio frequency microwave facility actually conflicts with the agricultural grazing on this property and is out of compliance with the county code. The location is off of Highway 120 now and going towards Aroma. It's cattle grazing land. And one of the things I submitted that I'll give to you is there's evidence of cattle dying, the calves being born deformed and blinded. Very recent report here from February of this year, mobile phone antennas laying the presence of cataracts and calves. I urge you to have this reconsidered and rescind the approval. Thank you.
Good morning. I thank Mr. Kramer and Ms. Garrett, as well as all of the folks that I habitually see in this community. My name is Coral Brune, and I live in Capitola. And with minimal notes here, I come to plead with the board, the town board, to please reconsider what's happening. And what I'm speaking about is with the smart meters, whether they're smart phones, smart meters, radiation from Fukushima. There has been this negligence that is occurring, and criminally speaking, because the vote was that smart meters weren't to be installed in Santa Cruz. And I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you, at first when I was a proponent of this, I was a supporter of those who were conditioned and had problems. And I, too, over the past months, after smart meters were installed in the apartment complex in which I live, although I opted out from my own individual place, the ones around me gradually have seemed to have affected my ability to, in the matter of sometimes it's worse than others, concentration. On February 11th, I started having heart and chest palpitations, headaches. Yesterday, I had the same feeling, nausea, lightheaded, dizziness. And it's a trembly kind of feeling where it goes through your body like you're being x-rayed all constantly. I never thought that I would have to come up here because I don't like to have to talk about this. It makes me angry. But also, until we incorporate free energy in the world, which would be a wonderful opportunity for human beings, we must address what's happening to our bodies and our minds. Our whole beings are being affected by this intermittent microwave action that's happening around us. I propose mandating regular meter detection tests of dangerous RF emissions from smart meters. If that would be possible, to have PG&E do regular tests of these smart meters to see how much radiation is actually coming out and how is it affecting the person that requests this. Also, that the person that requests removal, even if it is their neighbor or the surrounding area, to have some kind of conscience, a way to mitigate the effect of smart meters by the citizens in the county.
Hi, good morning. My name is Drew Lewis. I'm a resident of Santa Cruz. I just wanted to add some support to the previous speakers. As a homeowner and taxpayer, I was really shocked. I've been going to some of the court appearances of the Occupy people, and I was really shocked by the resources that are being drained from our court system to basically use the court system to harass people that are, nonviolent protesters that are exercising their rights of free speech. There's thousands of dollars that are being drained from our tax source to deal with real criminality in our society that's being drained into being used to harass people for basically free speech, nonviolent participation in the active movement here. Also, I'd like to mention that it seems our community is under attack. We see foreclosure fraud going on. It's destroying families, throwing people into the streets, putting a tremendous burden on our social services, having to deal with people without homes now. It's destroying our tax base. Now we don't have taxpayers paying into our taxes to support our community and our services. And with this smart meter thing issue going on, I read recently that there's been a 40% rise in brain tumors on the same side of the head as people using cell phones, and that the number one cause of death of infants is now brain tumors. So, I mean, these red flags are popping up all around us, and they're affecting all of us. And I think that we really need to start taking action against this because it's really destroying our communities. Thank you.
David Smith. I'm here today to speak on item 48.4, which is the... I know that. I'm not speaking on it. I just want to declare what I'm here for. Then I'm going to get to my other subject. But it's an interesting discussion about foreclosure that you've allowed here, and I support Occupy protests, but I'm not associated with them. I have an interesting perspective on this. I have a lawsuit against a Wall Street bank in the Ninth Circuit, San Jose. It's been going on for a year and a half now. And I will address my suggestions at 48.4 as to what the county, the recorder, and the sheriff can do about this. But now, I have some experience with your code enforcement department, which is now under the direction of the planning director, or specifically the building official. I have a couple of clients. And I'd like to encourage you to consider your what appears to me to be a more aggressive action against people in their homes, whether you can consider them to be legal or not, that you're removing people from their homes, you're condemning their homes, boarding them up, tearing them down. So my perspective is that you are acting like the bankers in this area. You're entering homes with your inspection warrants. In my case, you didn't give 24 hours to my client. It's required by Code of Civil Procedure 1822.5. You enter with the sheriffs and trumped up charges. You're looking for things like missing smoke detectors in order to enforce what you say you have adopted in the form of the dangerous building code. And I'm seeing a contrived situation here that's challengeable in courts. But what I want to say, I don't want to go too much into the legal of this. We will challenge these things later, perhaps in federal court, civil rights actions. But you need to consider whether you yourselves are throwing people out of their homes, doing the very same thing that we're protesting against banks, and not granting them true due process, setting them up for tricks and for tricks by certain code enforcement officers to entrap them, to surprise them with deputies, purposely withholding 24 hours notice. These things I'm concerned, I'm seeing it firsthand now because these are my people that I'm trying to protect their homes, and I will continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that actually was from the March, well, I guess the first supervisors meeting in March, about a month ago. I believe David Smith was also on a subsequent show, a Tuesday evening free radio show that comes up regularly every Tuesday evening. And I believe that show is called the Tangerine Dream Team. That's a show that often has some interesting guests, some interesting discussion. Free there is a legal eagle who covers a lot of issues. He's been particularly interested in Gary Johnson's case, some of the other sleep criminal cases, as one can sort of jovially call them, although their condition is not jovial. As far as I know, by the way, Gary Johnson, the man sentenced to 2.5 years in jail for sleeping with a protest sign outside the county building, is still at large. He's not a fugitive, but he is under a suspended sentence. So if he goes to sleep anywhere and a cop decides to arrest him, Judge Gallagher, Grim Gavel Gallagher, as I call him, can at any time, I guess, give him a hearing, but, you know, then essentially declare the suspended sentence no longer suspended. I'm not entirely clear about the process. I've been asking various legal minds who aren't also entirely clear about the process. Obviously, somebody here needs to do some research. But I was surprised that Gallagher didn't, when Gary refused probation, because he said, how can I agree to bail laws if one of them is that you can't sleep at night? I mean, you know, that's not really reasonable to expect me to obey. And Gallagher, instead of throwing the book at him and throwing him directly in jail, gave him all this suspended time, gave him credit for 80-some-odd days already served, and released him. I think he's embarrassed by this case, as he should be, seriously shamed by this case. I understand judges who want to keep licking the posteriors of the district attorney's office and the police department, or having a working relationship with them, need to somehow respect the tools, as they describe it, that they like to use, these anti-homeless laws, to roust and jack up and question, interrogate, search homeless people at night. But, in fact, these are massive and ongoing civil liberties violations. And they're also attacks on the dignity of people. And it's a further attack when people who peacefully protest these actions have their not only their civil rights removed, but are jailed for doing so, which is what happened to Gary Johnson, what faces Linda LeMaster, who's going up for trial for violating the so-called lodging law that Gary was convicted recently of violating by doing the same thing in much the same place. She sat next to a guy she was trying to take care of that night, who was one of the longtime protesters a year and a half ago, and show her solidarity with a protest that concerns itself with changing the anti-homeless sleeping ban law of Santa Cruz, which makes it illegal to sleep outside after 11 o'clock at night on all public property, no matter where. It doesn't provide any kind of sanctuaries, and we have a situation where there are 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people without shelter. Shelter for what? I guess tonight, it's April 5th. I think the Armory it ends on the 7th this year. So there'll be 46 not even walk-in spaces. There'll be no walk-in shelter, but there'll be programs that people can get on the waiting list of. But in the meantime, they're illegal at night, and they face criminalization. The part of the law that says you're allowed to get on a waiting list and have tickets dismissed is, it can be helpful for some, but it also puts the reins of authority in the hands of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, who has shown itself to be erratic, authoritarian, and also mendacious. That is to say, they are liars about these issues. And I don't trust that kind of a group, unfortunately. And it's just, for those who are more interested in that, you can read my stuff online about Monica Martinez, the executive director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, and also other people who have been involved with that whole process, which is only a token process anyway, or a very limited process. They no longer provide lockers, though they say they're going to put some in. They charge you for the mail. They don't allow you to actually use the Homeless Lack of Services Center as a refuge during the day. They patrol the outside of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. You can be denied services or harassed for exercising your constitutional rights on the sidewalks nearby. I mean, it's It's part of a growing trend, unfortunately. We talked with Mike Rhodes, Fresno Homeless Alliance activist, and you can read more about what's going on in Fresno online. People are fighting back there, unlike here, where all our time seems to be taken up fighting felony court cases, at least some of us. there's a story from Venice, which I think I read part of. I sent it off to the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Huff email list, which you can join if you want to be a part of the Huff email list, 423-HUFF. Give me a call, and I'll put you on the list. Occupy Venice, Venice locals, lawyers of the National Lawyers Guild, and a group called Venice Community Unity all came together. This is an April 2nd story. On 3rd Avenue in Venice to stop a homeless sweep from happening on March 29th. It was a good day. Venice is a little kind of seaside community. I think it's just south of Santa Monica, near Los Angeles. And I'll read a little bit of the story, which you can find on LA Indie Media. Councilman Rosenthal and City Attorney's Office of LA decided to actually move the beach as of February 2012. They claim that Oceanfront Walk, the Venice Boardwalk, is now not a street. They say it is now the beach, and therefore the Jones Settlement does not apply there. And I'll remind you that the Jones Settlement is the agreement that the City of Los Angeles and the Police Department of Los Angeles entered into with various attorneys and homeless groups that said they will not cite or arrest any homeless person for violating their Thou Shalt Not Sit, Lie, or Sleep law, provided the hours are at night, and provided they're 10 feet away from a business, and provided a certain amount of homeless housing hasn't been built, which, as far as I know, it hasn't happened. So that is supposed to be in effect. It's called the Jones Settlement, based on the name of Jones, one of the homeless people that won a court case called the Jones Decision in federal court. The Jones Settlement, unfortunately, is not precedent at all. It's a settlement, and therefore the Jones case has been what's called depublished or decertified. I'm never quite clear which. But we can't really cite it as any kind of ruling authority. But it does, in fact, supposedly is something of a break on police harassment against homeless people at night on the streets of Los Angeles, whereas in Santa Cruz there's absolutely no shelter for 95% of the homeless population. I'm not quite sure it's 95%, but it's some huge amount. And the courts recognized that, the federal courts, and said, you don't even have to walk to a homeless shelter and have knocked on the door and shown there's no beds that night. It is public knowledge and common knowledge that there is no shelter for their overwhelming majority, which is also the truth in Santa Cruz. But Judge Gallagher would not acknowledge that as a fact, although other authorities do. And the prosecution in the case of Gary Johnson say, oh, see, you could have gone to this one bed this one night, and therefore you don't have what's called a necessity defense. The prosecution brought in Monica Martinez, who I previously criticized here, the head of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, to testify that on certain nights there were beds open, even though it's generally understood you can't get access to those beds. And she knows as well as everyone else that there is, on any particular night, very little chance of anybody getting a bed at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, unless you happen to be in the program for which you signed up 6 weeks before and met their requirements. And then one of the requirements is you've not have been in that program for the month previous to that, unless they make some special exception for you, which that can happen too. But again, only for 46 people per month. So this is the same situation here. In any case, in Venice, according to this story, the Jones Settlement would have applied there as well because it's part of the greater Los Angeles area where this abusive anti-homeless Thou Shalt Not Sit, Lie, or Sleep law applies, somewhat similar to our sleeping ban, although it's 24 hours a day and not just at night. But the settlement allows you to sleep at night, so it's interesting. It does. It opens up that window that we don't have open. The claim now is, however, that the Venice Boardwalk is not really a street. It's a beach, and therefore is not covered by the Jones Settlement. This moved some of the homeless people who slept on the boardwalk up to 3rd Avenue, the only industrial street in Venice without homes. On March 7th, while most of the street people were off getting services or working, the LAPD came to 3rd Avenue with three large trash trucks and had street services throw away the personal belongings of over 50 homeless people. The LAPD, Los Angeles Street Services, and Councilmember Rosendahl's office were all partners on this sweep. People lost backpacks, suitcases, sleeping bags, personal items, medication, and papers or pictures that cannot be replaced. And this, of course, was the basis for a successful lawsuit over in Fresno in the Kincaid case. And in Santa Cruz, we have this as standard policy. They will post camps, and then they will come and destroy everything in the camp 2 or 3 days later in Labor Ready in the Poganip, with labor-ready crews and along the river and along the levee. And this has recently happened even without 24 hours of warning. And it's a violation not just of the Eighth Amendment to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, or Fifth Amendment, the right to be, it's Fourth Amendment, right to be secure in your persons and property. And maybe it's the Fifth Amendment, the right not to have your property taken without due process of law. But it also violates state law, which says you hold material for 60 to 90 days, which is supposedly now what Fresno authorities are supposed to be doing, although I think there's new actions being taken in court to take them to task for not doing that. But at least it is something that the law states, and everyone's so big in the law, if you trespass upon a bank, that's supposed to be a federal crime. But if you are destroying homeless people's property, that's how it goes. This kind of two-tiered classist system, of course, enrages many people, particularly people who are getting poorer and poorer. And it also enrages people who aren't in that situation, but who see it as unfair, and as just sort of not just unfair, but cruel, and see it as an outrage. And it is. It is an outrage. Continuing to read about the Venice situation, which I may not have time to read too much more of. That night, on March 7th, a legal clinic was arranged by the Venice Justice Committee and Legal Aid of Los Angeles. Venice Community Housing Corporation accessed emergency blankets. Occupy Venice came with food to give away and handed out the blankets. Without the blankets and the food, along with knowing someone cared, this sweep could have been much more devastating than it already was for the people who lost their property. No one should have to suffer such a clear violation of their civil rights and such a dehumanizing experience. Some housed Venice people who continually lobby Councilmember Rosendahl's office and the LAPD to remove homeless people from Venice think that having to see a homeless person is somehow a violation of a crazy, made-up NIMBY, not in my backyard, constitution, and they really believe that homeless people should be denied human or civil rights. They are ignorant. Denying sanitation or sleep to homeless people, criminalizing them, seizing their property, and throwing it away are violations of their human and civil rights. Furthermore, it is not any type of solution to homelessness. It is quite costly, and it is very mean. Until the county and the city of Los Angeles do the right thing by coughing up the money to actually solve homelessness by providing decent housing people can afford near or with services, Los Angeles will continue being the homeless capital. So, of course, the city planned another sweep on 3rd Avenue for March 29th. This time they put up one notice that they were coming in to clean the street, that is, remove people's belongings. And this time they were met with some resistance. Civil rights attorney Carol Sobel issued a press release March 28th, the day before, stating she filed a claim for damages on behalf of the people who lost property in the March 7th sweep, which is a prerequisite to filing a lawsuit against the city. That's also true in Santa Cruz. If you have lost property by people seizing it in uniforms or city crews sent out by people in uniforms or city bureaucrats, itemize the property you've lost, note when it was taken, note who took it, try to get some documentation. Photos are excellent, but just even assertions, affidavits mean something as well. I've been trying to encourage people to do this for the last 5 or 10 years, and my organizational skills are, of course, legendarily poor, and that hasn't happened. But you can leave such kind of notices and discussions and documentation of this at the Sub Rosa Cafe. You can come to the Huff meeting every Wednesday at 10 o'clock there. You can call me at 423-HUFF. I believe Food Not Bombs, which feeds weekly now, and I'm not quite sure where they're at these days. I think they're on Front Street at the paint They're in the parking lot of the paint store, which is across from, it's near the Community Credit Union, a little bit down on the other side of the street if you're a Front Street person. Or go to the Occupy Santa Cruz General Assembly meetings, either at 2 o'clock Saturday and Sunday at the post office, or at 6 o'clock Tuesdays and Thursdays on the steps of the courthouse next to Water Street, and talk to some folks there. Some folks there may have video cameras. They may have some way of hooking you up. We've got to document the fact that this property is being lost and destroyed here in Santa Cruz as well. Carol Sobel also asked the mayor to intercede to stop the March 29th sweep in Venice. Sobel and attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild showed up in early on March 29th on 3rd Avenue. Occupy Venice members came out. Venice locals who just knew it was wrong and Venice Community Unity all came to resist this sweep meant to remove the belongings of homeless people. There was tension. Despite public resistance, the LAPD and street services were going to throw away belongings that were clearly not garbage until Sobel called Rosendahl and convinced him to intercede. So, this time, no property was seized. Trash was removed from 3rd Avenue, but the belongings remain. It was a success. The only problem is that the city just keeps doing the same thing. Maybe it is a fantasy, but wouldn't it be cool if Rosendahl did something different? He could insist that there be proper notice given before any action or belongings might be seized. The city could provide trash cans with weekly pickup on 3rd Avenue. The city could also provide a maintained porta-potty. And if it gets trashy, community people can be notified so they can join with the street people to take care of it. This is a story in the L.A. Indy Media, and I've actually sent it out as a Huff email, which I send out about a dozen every week, called Venice Homeless Sweep Stopped, A Good Day in Venice for Street People. We need to do something similar for people here in Santa Cruz. And I was thinking of having a feeding event across, frankly, this is a certain element of personal interest here because of the prosecutions against me and 10 others around the 75 River Street occupation from November 30th to December 3rd. Invite homeless people to come and tell their stories, feed them, and also do this right outside Wells Fargo Bank, which is a large financial institution, which I'm told has engaged in some philanthropic activity, but apparently they have a large vacant bank building, which wouldn't be nice if they turned that into a community center. I know that was that might be considered poison to talk about, but I don't see why Wells Fargo officials shouldn't be approached and suggested that until such time as the building actually can be used as a bank and it can be rented to some prospective banker. I wonder why they would want to rent to somebody who would be competition for them anyway. Might it not be a good idea to render the homeless community a service and the community a service as well, the broader community, by making it available for people who have no legal place to go, have to be outside. It's miserable for them. It's not safe or sanitary for the rest of the community as well to have a situation where a lot of people have to live in squalor because they don't have access to a lot of otherwise vacant space and building. And I think this is a perfectly reasonable proposal. And if I'm going to be sent to jail for making it, so be it. In any case, my show is over. It is time for me to say sayonara. And I'll be back on Sunday, 9:30 in the morning, in my usual manner. Again, looking for better things to do, but not yet finding them. If you got that stuff you want on the air, or you want to be interviewed, or you want to make some comments about what you've heard, you can give me a call at 423-4833. That's the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line. Or you can email me at rnorse@hotmail.com. And I will respond. Other stuff that I didn't get to cover on this particular show included the pepper spraying in Santa Monica at the community college. Quite something that was, as usual, essentially puffed for the authorities and the police by establishment media, and I wanted to do some correcting there, and perhaps I will on Sunday. Why Anonymous is not a threat to national security. Anonymous is a loosely knit group of internet activists who, along with WikiLeaks have been responsible for exposing the growing war crimes in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere around the world by the U.S. and other criminal governments, and also corporate criminals such as Wells Fargo and Bank of America and so forth. I was going to look into the latest up in Berkeley and Oakland and the Occupy movements up there, the Occupy San Francisco occupation, where one of our own Occupy activists, Anthony, was assaulted by a police officer. He writes about that on the Occupy Santa Cruz website. All that perhaps I'll be able to get to, or at least some of it, on Sunday, unless somebody else gets to it first, which would be even better. There's another story. Occupy Oakland confronts discriminatory prosecutions. Looked like it's happening up there, too, by the OPD and the DA. And I think I'll post something on that story. That's in East Bay Santa Indy Media, East Bay Indy Media rather than Santa Cruz Indy Media. And you can get that by going to indybay.org/